Hello, and thanks for joining us in the Measure Pod, a podcast for people in the analytics world. I'm Dara, I'm MD at Measure Lab, and I'm joined as always by Dan, an analytics consultant, also at Measure Lab. Hey Dan, how you doing?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm also good. I'm excited. We've got a guest on this week, which is always good. So we're joined by somebody who we know from something called the Crap Talks, and that's not me being insulting. That is the actual name of it. I'm sure I'm not the first one to make that joke, but we'll get to that and we'll give Bav a chance to talk to us a little bit about Crap. But we're joined by Bav Patel. So Bav, what we usually do, instead of just getting people to do a kind of standard introduction, we usually ask them how they fell into the world of analytics, because most people we speak to, they've kind of meandered into it. So in as much or as little detail as you want, give us a little bit of your backstory and how you got to where you are today.
So thanks for having me on the show, guys. I'm Bav. I'm currently the head of product analytics at a startup called Hopin. And how I fell into analytics, you're absolutely right. I didn't plan to land in it. I graduated from university having studied maths. Like most graduates, I was just after a job that was remotely related to my field. I stumbled initially into digital marketing. So I was doing PPC, SEO, display advertising, agency side. I really enjoyed the analysis side of looking at our client data, but they were so limited in how much I could actually get access to, just because being a marketing agency, we'd only really get access to the ad networks. So I made the decision to move in-house and I've just never looked back since. So I think for me, it was really around kind of like going deeper into the funnels to understand what user behavior was looking like. And slowly, what I realized was I was spending more and more time trying to understand customer journeys, what on-site behavior looked like. And even though I was in a growth marketing role, I found myself doing a lot of the analytics for the company. And that resulted in me being promoted into a head of analytics role at my first company where this happened. And then I kind of like been on a analytics / data / experimentation journey ever since. I don't know if you guys remember when you're in year 11 and in high school, you have your national record of achievement. So I dug my national record of achievement out. And in it, I talked about what I really loved about the subjects I loved. That was art and science and maths. And it really talked about how with science, there's a kind of like a concrete answer. And I loved experimentation. So I never thought I would be a scientist. I wanted to be a scientist growing up, but then you kind of hit like 25, 26, 27 years old, and you realize that kind of like dream of what you wanted to do as a kid is forever fading. And then one day I woke up, I was like 33 years old, and I was looking through this record, and I realized that actually I'm doing a lot of experimentation and A-B testing. So in some ways it is kind of related, like, you know, maybe this is me retrospectively trying to fit some lifelong childhood dream into like the reality of what I actually do. That's kind of how I ended up in analytics. And I just never looked back. I kind of love the field.
I love that. And you've actually proved me wrong as well.
Well, kind of. I mean, I really wanted to be a proper scientist, right? Like, I by no stretch of the imagination consider myself a scientist. But when you start doing A-B testing and you start looking at p-values and normal distributions, you can kind of say you are. I'm sure, like, you know, Isaac Newton is turning in his grave, listening to his podcast and hearing me talk.
So I introduced you by saying that Dan and I saw you at the Crap Talks that you organized. So before we probably dig into our actual topic this week, let's have a quick chat about Crap. So can you give us a bit of background to it? What inspired you to set it up? Maybe any plans you have to reinstate it?
So I think it came out of frustration. It was born out of frustration. First and foremost, CRAP is actually an acronym. It stands for Conversion Rate, Analytics, and Product. I'm sure most people are familiar with silos in companies. You kind of hear about like silos and breaking silos. Yet within the industry, when we go to events, we kind of like reaffirm these silos, and we have analytics events, we have product events, we have marketing events, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of like why there was this discipline. And if you put a Venn diagram together with conversion optimization, analytics, and product as three circles, the intersection is where I was trying to put CRAP. So that's kind of like the premise behind it. And why I started, it was purely just out of frustrations. I think the final nail on the coffin was I went to this event, I think it was Marketing Week Live or something like that. And it's a 5-day event with each day dedicated to a specific track. One of the days was data and analytics. So naturally, that was the one I went to. And I remember the first event, the speakers on stage, they were massively underqualified to be on that stage talking to the audience that they were talking to. And all I heard for the 45-minute duration of this fireside chat were cliches, big data this, and, you know, big data that. And I got really fed up because I had so much work to do. I'd taken a day out of my week to attend what I thought was going to be a highly relevant event for myself. And it just fell flat on its face. So when I got back to the office, I said, I'm going to start my own one. I created a page on meetup.com, put an event in the calendar for a couple of months later, and then prayed for the best. I think it was the first event. I think we had about 12 people turn up. Then by the end of the evening, we're like, we should do this again. So we did again. Next time, 20 people turned up. And again, the intimacy of the event was really great. We were able to have meaningful discussions. The people in the room were practitioners who were, you know, pretty much in the trenches, doing this day in and day out and highly qualified to be there. And then that kind of like continued snowballing, and it was through word of mouth that the next event we had kind of like 50. After that, there was 100 attendees. I think at peak, we had nearly 190 attendees at the event we ran at Expedia, the Expedia offices during summer. It was really great to see this grow organically, and everyone had such great things to say about it. And with each event that followed, it just kept getting better and better, and I just wanted to do more events. And then lockdown hit, unfortunately. And I've tried to do a few virtual events. I just haven't had the bandwidth and capacity to do it. I still wanted to contribute to the community. So I started writing. I genuinely believe in the power of the written word and the spoken word. So I figured if I couldn't run events where people were able to share their knowledge verbally, I wanted to write it down. I joined a writing community, and I've just been writing about the same topics, CRO, crap-related topics, but it's been nice to continue contributing, even if it's not in the same way.
We were really big fans. I don't know if it was at the Expedia one or if maybe it was the one before that, but it was really good. I always loved the content. I think we could probably echo what you said about being frustrated about some of the industry events where they're glorified sales pitches, aren't they, in a lot of cases, or just an excuse to throw out lots and lots of buzzwords. But we were big fans of Crap because it was really top-notch speakers, and it was a good mixture of content as well, because it spanned those different disciplines. It wasn't just in one area. So what I found great about it was I would get the most out of the speakers that were less related to the work that we do. So as an analytics practitioner, I got more out of maybe the people who specialize in conversion rate optimization, or the people who are working in product analytics roles, because you're getting that kind of transferable knowledge from other domains. That was kind of refreshing, because otherwise you go to these events and often it's a bit of a case of mutual backpatting or just getting to sit there and think, wow, yeah, I know all of this already, which can be nice stroke to the ego, but you don't actually learn anything. You don't come away with any kind of different thoughts or different approaches to how you're going about your job.
I think that was the most surprising thing for me that I discovered, is what I assumed would happen were the people who were from within the discipline that the speaker was, that would be the talk that resonated most with them or they got the most value out of. But as you mentioned, I found often the feedback, because I collect a lot of data after the events, like through surveys, and the feedback is always very similar around, actually, the most enjoyable talks for everyone else was when it was from another discipline, because it kind of like opened their eyes to what was happening in other parts of the organization, which they maybe didn't have access to before. So that was kind of cool to see that happen.
So one thing we wanted to dig into with you a little bit, because Dan and I, and at Measure Lab, we're often focused on marketing analytics, not exclusively, by and large, it's marketing analytics, and we're working with marketing teams. So you mentioned that your current role is head of product analytics. So what's product analytics as distinct from marketing analytics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think historically, the tech industry has relied on marketing-led growth. So this is going out and doing your PPC advertising, your SEO, your digital advertising, doing your TV, your display, your social media, all of those types of advertising, and then growing through marketing-led activities. And I think what's happened is over the last like 3 or 4 years, there's been a shift in dynamic towards more product-led growth. And you see companies who, not to say they're not doing any marketing analytics, but actually their primary engine for growth comes via the adoption of the product and getting users to use it, either through offering it at a very subsidized rate or completely free in the case of products like Spotify and Slack. So what product analytics focuses on, I guess you could say it's a different branch of the same tree. And it's really about trying to find opportunities of growth by using your product as the main lever to attract customers, engage them, and then retain them. So I think historically, companies have been great at driving traffic to the website and getting people to download their app or their product, whatever it was. But then where it's really fallen apart is there hasn't been that same level of focus on the user experience and building a product that is truly sticky. And I think it was only when you started seeing companies like Slack, like Spotify, heavily invest in their product first and things like the marketing and stuff second, I think companies started seeing that as a more sustainable engine for growth. You can attract all the customers in the world and all the traffic in the world. But if you then lose them after your first or second step, or if they're using a subpar product, you've wasted all of this marketing spend. So really, I think in an ideal situation, when we talk about product analytics, marketing analytics, they really complement each other. But historically, it's only really just been a focus on marketing analytics. And it's now great to see more and more companies hire for this product analyst role. And I've seen it day in and day out. Like either being reached out directly from recruiters who are looking to hire leaders in the product analytics space, or companies hiring for their first product analyst. And I've read a couple of posts around what I look for when I'm hiring. And the skill sets, they're not dramatically different between a product analyst and a marketing analyst. But I think the big changes come from like mindset. So the technical skill sets are really going to be the same, but it's really about the mindset of how you approach the problem and understanding of the space you're in. Whereas marketing, you're focused on things such as ROI and CPAs and optimizing the cost of your marketing spend. Product analytics is really focused on understanding your business metrics. So looking at your unit economics, understand, well, okay, this is how we make money. Our primary goal might be revenue. And then we break it down into subcomponents. So we get deeper and deeper and deeper until we start hitting those behavioral metrics, which then ladder up to your revenue metrics. And of course, one arm of that will be marketing spend and traffic acquired to the site. But there's this big arm, which is really around behavioral analysis and the quality of the product and how sticky it is and how people use it. I would say really that's the core difference between product analytics and marketing analytics.
And you mentioned silos earlier. So how do you avoid that either in your current role or just generally, how would you advise people to avoid the silo effect between maybe if there is a distinct marketing analytics team and then a product analytics team?
So when I was working at Gusto, my previous company, they have one of the best setups when it comes to team structures. So rather than having like these siloed teams, actually what we have is these multidisciplinary tribes and squads, and they're made up of product analysts, they're made up of growth managers, they're made up of product managers, engineering managers, designers, researchers. And actually what you have is this group of people who have very unique skill sets all working to solve the same problem, as opposed to this homogenous group of people who all have the same skill set working on the same problem. And, you know, you don't get the same diversity of thought. So I think that's probably the best way. I think Gusto nailed it. Where I'm working right now, we don't have the same team structures, but I guess my approach is communication. So I think one of the things I learned a lot at Gusto is like the best things you can do, especially when you're working in these remote conditions that most of us are working in at the moment, there's no such thing as oversharing. And I think keeping people informed about what you're doing is the best way to keep them in the loop. Because I think working in this remote environment, we miss those kind of like coffee chats and those water cooler chats. But moving to a remote environment, the act of over-communicating just to keep people informed, I think that's probably the best way to overcome silos.
So is it fair to say then, so going back to the product analytics, marketing analytics, it's like the marketing analytics is driving people in or driving the kind of top of the funnel activity, trying to widen that, trying to get people in. You've got the kind of CRO kind of middle of the funnel, trying to convert them once they're on the website or the application. And then the kind of product analytics is more about retention, and it's about creating that sticky product so there's less churn. So in a sense, we're working in the same funnel. We're just at different ends of that funnel, and different roles or different focuses have different areas of specialisms.
Yeah, and I don't see CRO as really a role. I see it as more of a skill set. So there's no reason why a marketing analyst couldn't do CRO. It's really around conversion optimization. You test your ad copy, you might test landing pages, you might test images, you know, whatever it is that you're doing on the marketing side of things. When we're talking about the acquisition now, for some companies, they might call their acquisition team like a CRO team, but actually, generally where I've worked, that is a product team or it's a marketing team or it's a more traditional skill set, like product analytics, you know, whatever it might be. And CRO is just the skill sets that you apply to it. I think right now we have, you know, like it's a group of CRO practitioners. But yeah, ultimately, you're working on the same funnel. Product analytics might be further up. So if you think about the acquisition, that actually happens on the product. So when you look at your form analytics, that's still your product. I think ultimately, you're right. It's all one funnel, but I think product analytics and marketing analytics, there's a gray area somewhere very early on in the user experience.
So I think you've kind of answered what my next question was going to be there, but I was going to ask you about whether you're doing experimentation within the product analytics team, and I think you've just said you are.
So we're not doing experimentation at Hopin right now, but however, when I was like working at Gusto, we were doing a lot of experimentation. There's really two schools of thought around experimentation, and this is what we had at Gusto and what we've had at previously at our previous companies, is you've got your first school, which is a centralized experimentation team who will run A-B tests at, you know, as a central function. They might be made up of product managers, growth managers, designers, or you've got your centralized team. The centralized team are really there to create an environment of experimentation. They're there to facilitate an experimentation mindset. And I think that one scales much better. So when I say I do experimentation, I won't lie and sit there and say, hey, I come up with all these great ideas. I always have great ideas, but I've been told constantly bad ideas are cheap, execution is everything. But I much prefer creating an environment where other people can run experiments themselves. So like a centralized team who will share things like how we designed the experiment, what are the experiments happening across the site, and really share best practices and educate stakeholders and product managers and marketing managers and whoever else to think about how we might prove causality or our hypotheses through the use of experimentation as a tool as opposed to as a team. So yes, I do experimentation. I have run experiments, but I much prefer an environment where me and my team can facilitate experimentation. And Gusto, again, was the best example I can think of. When you've got a centralized team of experiment professionals or CROs, what you get is you've kind of ring-fenced your domain expertise, usually to some low-hanging fruit. However, when you expand the remit of experimentation and allow other teams to experiment, what you also get with them is deep domain knowledge. And the best example I can think of is when I was working at Gusto, we were planning how to do experiments in our supply chain. Now, I couldn't tell you one bit about how supply chain works. However, our product manager, he was fantastic. He knew the ins and outs of our supply chain. So all I really needed to do was arm him about how we might design an experiment to prove what it was we were trying to prove. So in this case, we were trying to improve throughputs, the number of boxes we can get out of the production line. I can't do that. And I think this is one of the ugly truths of CRO, and you don't hear about it a lot, is because you've got people talking about, you know, copy, and you've got people talking about like behavioral mindsets. But actually, that's all very surface level information. I would much prefer a product manager or a marketing manager who spends day in and day out in their discipline running an experiment than having a team who will do some high level, surface level understand, you know, experimentation based on very limited knowledge of what their area is. And I think that's really the only way for experimentation to be successful. Like, you might get a few good winning tests, you might get some ideas that prove their value, but ultimately I don't think it beats deep domain knowledge. And if you can arm those teams with the knowledge of how to run a proper experiment, then you're more likely to see your experimentation as a program of work succeed rather than the individual experiments.
Yeah, that makes complete sense, because you're going to naturally, you'll hit the end of the road with that low-hanging fruit. And if you're not actually embedding it into the teams themselves, then you're going to run out of road, aren't you? So shifting focus slightly, we talk on this podcast a lot about Google Analytics, because that's the main analytics tool that we work with. So you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of comparable kind of technical skills between somebody who might be in a product analyst role versus a marketing analyst. What about the tool sets? Are you using different tool sets, different technology to do your work compared to what maybe we might be doing if we're using GA to analyze marketing campaigns?
Yeah, so I think certainly in my experience, Google Analytics is very strong when it comes to understanding your marketing activity, what's driven traffic to your site. It works quite well for like an e-commerce platform when you have to like prove ROI value at a channel and a spend level. But when you start going deep into the product, it has its own limitations. I think the teams that I've traditionally worked with much prefer working with more bespoke event tracking based tools. And I think GA4 is moving towards event tracking for this purpose. And I'm not really used GA4 myself. I've seen it floating in the analytics ecosystem all over the place and seems to be a very hot topic right now. And I've stayed very clear of that topic just because I don't really have an opinion on it. However, from a product analytics perspective, I guess it doesn't really matter about the tool. For me, it's really around the strategy that goes behind tracking. So right out of the bat, if you've got a poor implementation of your event tracking, it doesn't matter what tool you use. Ultimately, you're not going to be able to gain the insights you need to improve that product. And I think that's probably true in some cases of marketing as well, right? If you haven't set up your parameters well, you're not going to really be able to track your traffic. And I think the quality of your marketing analytics depends on the quality of the parameters that you put in and how well you are able to segment them, look at it at a very granular level. If you only just tagged it as, you know, Facebook or email, or you know, something like that, it's not going to be very useful. And I think in that sense, product analytics is very similar. So I think one of the things that, you know, just slightly moving away from the topic of the technology, one thing that companies tend to forget, and it's a term I'm coining, and I'm calling it analytical debt. You see companies spend tons and tons of time trying to improve their technical debt, and actually they forget that your event tracking is part of your wider tech ecosystem. And by not naming your event tracking properly, by not using proper naming conventions, by not passing the correct parameters, you're racking up this debt, which means that you're just collecting all this superfluous information, which isn't very useful in the grand scheme of things. And I think in the same way, it's like marketing analytics, exactly the same. The better the quality of your tracking, the better you can analyze your marketing campaigns and build things like attribution models and all of those types of things. So yeah, I mean, I'm quite agnostic at the end of the day. My mindset has generally been, I don't care what tool someone gives me. It's really around how we use it, how we set it up, how do we minimize that analytical debt and ensure that a year from now, we're not spending time cleaning up events and cleaning up tags and, you know, all of that boring stuff that no one wants to do. So it really should be an ongoing exercise.
You're preaching to the choir, really. And I think that this is something that we're seeing as well. And I think, although you're saying you kind of avoided the GA4 conversation, like we've not been able to, obviously, and that's very much been our day-to-day for the last couple of years. But actually, we're finding that it actually affords us an opportunity to clear a lot of analytical debt, as you said. So it's actually like a lot of the legacy historical nuance, the implementation, the tracking, the kind of stuff that is just in the way and maybe overcomplicating things in Universal and the data points they're capturing there. We're getting a fresh start because it's not transferable. You can't just take your Universal Analytics and convert it to GA4. You actually have to start from scratch. It's implementing a brand new product and it's making everyone take a step back and go, what do we need? what's our objective? What's our purpose? I can't talk to it as maybe as well as you can, but from a GA4 perspective, I'm seeing a lot of conversation around the product analytics space because of that event schema you suggested and how it is kind of opening a couple of doors or making it more relevant for different functions, especially things like the kind of connection to BigQuery. So you get all the access to all the raw data as part and parcel of this. So you can kind of do whatever you want with that data. Yeah, I'm not here to promote GA4 in any way, but it's definitely something that I've noticed. It's that clearing of the analytical debt, but also conversation around the event schema and how that can be useful from a product analytics perspective has been something that's been coming up quite a lot, actually.
It's really interesting, actually. I never thought about it like that. And you're absolutely right. I guess it's somewhat like switching to a different platform, albeit it's the same vendor. It's a different platform. So joining Hopin, one of the opportunities we had was to build our event tracking from scratch. So it's kind of been nice to build this from scratch and identify kind of like your nomenclature about how we might name events and things like that. Now, one of the challenges we're facing is as the teams are scaled and as the teams become a bit more self-sufficient in learning how to track their own events, governance becomes a critical topic. And again, it doesn't get talked about enough in this space. You're going to go through all of this pain of migrating over all of your tracking over onto GA4, which is a great opportunity to, like, you know, get rid of all the crap. What you're going to find is a year from now, all of those kind of like events that have been added straight into the live environment, production environment, they're going to start to like rear their ugly head. And what you're going to do is you're going to rebuild your analytical debt. So if anyone is listening, and you know, I hope they take me very seriously when I say this, please consider the governance as part of the cleanup process, because I can't stress enough how on a regular basis going through and we're finding events, we're like, hang on, these have not been approved by the team. How do they get there? And it's just engineers like adding test events and they're making their way into our live environment, and it's an absolute pain. So yeah, governance. If there's one thing you take away today about event tracking, it's the governance piece.
You're not going to get any disagreement here. I think it's a classic case of people repeating their mistakes, isn't it? And we've talked on this show a few times about using this migration to GA4 as that chance to do a spring cleanup. That's only as useful as long as you stick to that governance. And it's very easy for people to just fall into the same habits. So you're right. It's like review it, drop the debt, but make sure it stays gone and stick to your governance and make sure that if you're implementing events that they're actually going to be used and everybody's clear on what they're for and any nuances with the data or anything else.
This is the thing, isn't it? We say it's a great opportunity to have a clean slate and start again, but starting again with the same mindset, it's all about when we say it's a good opportunity for a clean slate or to start again, we're saying in terms of process more than anything. It actually doesn't matter about the events and stuff you're tracking, exactly as you said, Bav, it's that governance. When we do this, as everyone is having to do this right now, let's write it down. Let's start with that. Let's just write it down on a piece of paper, digital paper nowadays, but stick it on a piece of digital paper somewhere, put it down, put a date against it and start with that. What is good governance is how long is a piece of string kind of conversation. But if you're not doing anything, start with something. And actually, you can migrate every single event into GA4 if that's useful, but just write it down and justify it somehow.
I think it's also, you know, as much as it is around like redefining your processes and doing this from scratch, it's an opportunity to re-educate people about the importance of event tracking. Because what I found is, and I created this meme a while ago, you guys have seen the movie The Matrix, right? You know that scene where one of the agents fires a gun at Neo and he kind of like starts dodging the bullets. I kind of see those bullets as the owners of event tracking. And it's kind of like everyone's trying to dodge it. Data engineering are dodging it, product engineering are dodging it, software engineering are dodging it, analytics are dodging it. And you realize that there isn't any natural owner of your event tracking. And I think this is one of the main reasons why it ends up being this Frankenstein's monster of this thing that ends up being a pain in the ass for everyone.
So what does your kind of general tech stack look like? Because we've talked a lot about kind of mindset and team structure and governance, but what's your kind of typical setup?
So I think for me, what's been fairly consistent, even if the tools are slightly different, there's one event pipeline. In our case, we use Segment, which captures all of the on-site data, you know, your front-end events, your back-end events, which gets pushed into our data warehouse. We then enrich that. It's really cool, actually. I've not seen it elsewhere, but the enrichment service basically adds on all of the information you probably would have joined later on in the analysis stage, right at the early stages. And then that gets pushed into Amplitude, which is our product analytics tool. It also gets pushed into Redshift, and the BI tool that sits on top of that is Looker, where we make a lot of this information available. I have tried and tried and tried again to embed the self-serve mindset into companies. And I don't know why. I don't know about you guys, and I'd love to hear from your opinion. How successful you've been. I'd love to hear from you guys. How do you solve this?
This is exactly what we experienced too. I think it's really interesting, this whole concept of data democracy. And it's like how much freedom you give someone to access. Because, you know, on paper, it's like you have access to everything. You can self-serve. You can build everything you want. But actually, with all of that comes a relative risk because people go grab things that they don't realize they're grabbing and it's wrong. But actually, that's not the biggest issue. The biggest issue is just getting them to use it in the first place. I assume it's different for every business, or it is from my experience. It's almost like creating the kind of democracy of the data, the kind of self-serve nature is great, but actually it's almost for our benefit, not theirs.
So I guess why do we keep talking about this democratization of data? There's clearly like a ceiling, which is significantly lower than we all care to believe or accept. And maybe self-serve reporting is the best we're ever going to get.
Yeah.
I believe that without the work that kind of we do, the quality of decision-making will continue to deteriorate, which will then ultimately have an impact on business performance, which will then ultimately lead to this kind of crash.
Where does something like privacy and cookie policies and things like the literal ability to be able to collect the data, whether it's analytics has been turned off or whether the technology is making it worse and worse and worse, is that the same kind of effect you feel that's going to eventually kind of become a downfall?
I recently shared a blog post about my thoughts on data privacy. Right. I think Silicon Valley and these tech industries has made billions and billions by exploiting our data. And now they're on track to make billions and billions by convincing us we need to protect it. Right. So I don't think the average person really generally cares about data protection in that sense. Because, I mean, worst case scenario, what are they going to do? They're going to target me with slightly better ads.
All right. We're going to change gears now. This is the bit in the show where we put each other on the spot to pretend we have interesting lives outside of work. So I'm gonna ask you what you've been doing recently to kind of wind down outside of work.
Good question. So I have two boys. So the concept of wind down, it's so far in the past that I don't remember. But if I do get some time, it'll be one of a few things. I like to write. So at the start of 2021, I started writing. I joined a writing community. I made a very conscious effort to improve my writing style. I think I've clocked in over nearly 1,000 hours of writing over the last year and a half. So I'll spend some time doing that. Or alternatively, if I can't be bothered to write and I don't want to watch Netflix, I like to paint and draw in my spare time. I'm in the process of learning a Japanese art style, which uses this one colored ink, and you create different shades and create these really moody images and pictures. So that's been kind of fun to go on that journey. But that's how I kind of wind down. How about you guys?
Yeah, brilliant. Dan, follow that if you can.
I'm not going to attempt because, yeah, it's terrible. But my wind down was the Great British Sewing Bee. And it's basically, for anyone that doesn't know that, it's basically the Great British Bake Off, but for sewing. And it's a bunch of people that get together and sew in a room once a week, and it is so lovely. I like sewing. I've always been around textiles my whole life growing up. Both my parents were in the trade. So it's always been a bit of a soft spot for me. And it's just one of those lovely non-competition programs that we have. But yeah, Great British Sewing Bee. How about you, Dara?
Yeah, it's where they all want each other to win, isn't it? I've seen it before. It's competition with no actual competitive mean streaks at all. They're all wishing each other well and best friends. Mine's very, very boring. It's Netflix related. We've just finished off the final series of Ozark, and I can't really say anything about it in case anybody is watching it and hasn't seen the end yet. So all I'll say is we finished it, and that is it. End of update.
I was going to say, I heard Ryan Reynolds message the main actor. I've forgotten his name.
Jason Bateman.
Yeah, he literally just said, "You're so fucking talented."
That's an amazing text to get, right? Ryan Reynolds randomly texts you.
Yeah. Well, I really want to talk about the ending, but I won't, just in case I give any spoilers away. Okay, final question for you, Bav. An easy one, and then you're pretty much off the hook. But where can people find out more about you or even get in touch if you want them to?
So it depends on how much you want to hear from me. LinkedIn is always a great place for me just generally sharing things I find interesting or I've written. But Twitter is where I really rant. So my Twitter handle is @dodonerd, D-O-D-O-N-E-R-D. Don't ask why. That's just my handle. So yeah, LinkedIn or Twitter is usually my go-to places for communications.
Great. And Dan, what about you?
Not Twitter for me. I have a Twitter account, but I'm not very talkative on there. But LinkedIn for me and my website, danalytics.co.uk.
And for me, it's LinkedIn. Okay, that's it from us for this week. As always, you can find our previous episodes of the MeasurePod in our archive over at measurelab.co.uk/podcast. If you want to suggest a topic for us to discuss, or better still, come on the MeasurePod and discuss it with us, you can email podcast@measurelab.co.uk, or you can reach out to myself or Dan or both of us on LinkedIn, and we can arrange that. Our theme music is from Confidential. We've got links to their Spotify and their Instagram in our show notes. I've been Dara, joined by Dan, and also this time by Bav. So it's a bye from me.
Bye from me.
And bye from me.
See you next time.
Sorry, can we start that bit again?